طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. It has been another rough couple of weeks in the Palestinian camp. We saw the unrelenting assault of the Israeli lobby take place in the defeat of Donna Edwards in the Democratic House of Representatives primary in Maryland. Edwards, who has served 3 terms in the House, led substantially early in the polls against her opponent, but then the Israeli lobby went after her because of her pro-Palestinian positions, pouring over $6 million into defeating her. This is typical of the lobby, which historically has gone after legislators who have not towed to the Israeli line. It is why the lobby is pouring millions of dollars right now into defeating Rashida Tlaib and Huwaida Araf in Michigan, and Ilhan Omar in Minnesota, among others. The U.S. Congress is owned by the Israeli lobby, and only we can change that by paying attention to what is happening in the current election season. Okay, moving on to our feature presentation. Today on This Week in Palestine, we take another look at the fallout from the recent reports by international human rights organizations who have issued concurring exhaustive reports documenting that Israel indeed meets the protocols of apartheid under international law. The United States Congress and the White House have condemned the reports by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and B'Tselem, without commentary as to why, without any critical analysis of the actual reports, but by putting down the reports with the usual name-calling of anti-Semitism. Today we feature a conversation between Paul O'Brien of Amnesty International, Dr. Maha Nasser of the University of Arizona, and Peter Beinart at CUNY, with Laura Friedman, president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, discussing the Amnesty report, which provides a detailed and thorough examination of Israel's treatments of Palestinians and concluding that it meets the legal definition of the crime of apartheid. This conversation explores another aspect of this issue, the dynamics and tactics, some new, some old, on display in the responses from defenders of the status quo to the growing use and acceptance of the apartheid framing, including deflection and misdirection aimed at shifting focus away from factual findings and delegitimization and demonization of human rights defenders and Palestinian rights activists. We begin with Laura Friedman framing the issue.
So last month, as probably everybody who is listening or watching this knows, Amnesty International published a detailed and thorough report examining Israel's treatment of Palestinians and concluding that it meets the legal definition of the crime of apartheid. With that conclusion, Amnesty joined the ranks of international and Israeli NGOs, including Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, and Yesh Din, as well as Palestinian and organizations and advocates like Al-Haq and Al-Mizan, who have likewise concluded that Israel's treatment of Palestinians amounts to the crime of apartheid. And just last week, the UN Special Rapporteur, Michael Link, articulated the same conclusion in an official report to the UN Security Council. Now, the Foundation, us, have held a whole lot of events already, exploring the meanings and the implications of the term apartheid for understanding the Israeli regime and its treatment of Palestinians. If you missed those events, I encourage you to check them out now and look to the chat box. You'll see links. Today, we're exploring something a little bit different, another aspect of the issue. And this is the dynamics and tactics, some new, some old, on display in the responses from defenders of the apartheid status quo in Israel-Palestine to the growing use and acceptance of the apartheid framing. And we have with us today three experts. They're here to talk about different things. We're honored and thrilled to have them with us. I'm going to introduce them in reverse alphabetical order for a change. First, we have Paul O'Brien. Paul is the executive director of Amnesty International USA, based in Washington. Previously, Paul was at Oxfam America. And during the pandemic, Paul co-led Oxfam's worldwide influencing network's efforts to change government policies, corporate practice, and public opinion. Now, Paul is with us to talk about Amnesty's recent report, the actual facts of the report, the context, all of that, about apartheid. That's his role today. We also have with us Dr. Maha Nassar. Dr. Nassar is an associate professor in the School of Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Arizona, go Wildcats, that's my alma mater, where she specializes in the cultural and intellectual history of the modern Arab world. And she is the 2022 fellow at the Foundation for Middle East Peace. We are very honored to have her. And by the way, we are still recovering from the Wildcats loss in Sweet 16. And last, we have Peter Beinart. Peter teaches national reporting and opinion writing at the Newmark J School, Journalism School, and Political Science at CUNY Graduate Center. Peter is editor-at-large for Jewish Currents and a fellow at the Foundation for Middle East Peace and author of the Beinart Notebook newsletter on Substack. And I will add that all three of our speakers have extraordinarily impressive CVs. You should check those out on the webpage for this event. They've also written books and articles, and you can find the links to that in the chat box. Okay, we're going to go right in. I wasted 4 minutes of our time with introductions. I apologize for that. Let's start in. Maha, I'm going to start with you. For a lot of people watching or listening, the debate around the use of the term apartheid, including efforts by defenders of Israel to reject the term, may seem kind of new, maybe dating back only to last year's report by Human Rights Watch or last month's report by Amnesty International. Now, as a scholar of cultural and intellectual history, can you start us off with some context with respect to apartheid awareness activism among Palestinian intellectuals and activists? And can you talk about how Palestinians see this moment when the Overton window, as people call it, is shifting due to non-Palestinian voices finally saying what Palestinians have been saying for years?
Sure. Thank you so much, Laura, for having me. And thanks for that question. So yes, you're absolutely right. Palestinians have long been making the connection between Israel's treatment of Palestinians and the system of apartheid. Now, importantly, they've understood that the system of apartheid isn't an end in and of itself, but rather is a tool to advance Israeli settler colonialism. So one of the earliest scholars to make this link was a Palestinian intellectual named Fayez Sayer. And in 1965, he wrote on Zionism as colonialism and made the connection to the apartheid regime in South Africa and others. I'll give just one brief quote. He wrote in 1965, quote, "The Zionist settler state has learned all the lessons which the various discriminatory regimes of white settler states in Asia and Africa can teach it," unquote. So this pointing out of Israel's racialized discrimination and its connection with other settler states is a connection that Sayer was making back in 1965. In other words, 2 years before the 67 war and the Israeli occupation. So it's an argument that goes back even before the occupation itself, and it points to a more foundational critique of Israel and its practices of apartheid and racialized discrimination. And this linking of Israel and Zionism as an ideological movement that's based in racialized discrimination, we also see this playing out in the 70s was Palestinians continued to advance this argument in international bodies. So some people might remember the UN General Council resolution in 1975, resolution 3379, which determined that Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination. And so this racialized understanding of Zionism, or an understanding that Zionism is a racial project, continues throughout the 70s and then into the 80s, where we see Palestinians around the world, including here in the US, very much a part of the international boycott movement against apartheid South Africa. And I think it's because they recognize the close parallels of structural oppression that Palestinians and Black South Africans both faced. Now, there was a lull in some of this discourse in the 1990s as the peace process narrative dominated. But with the collapse of the peace process in 2000 and then the outbreak of the Second Intifada, we see a return and a reemergence of Palestinians more directly calling out Israel's system of apartheid. And I think it's crucial to note here that this reemergence was led by a younger generation of Palestinians and other Arabs, often students, many of whom were born or raised in the West, in the US and Europe. And so they were acutely aware of this policing of discourse that we're talking about today. And so they were very keen to bring their understanding of Israel as enacting structures of oppression to a Western audience that wasn't aware of it. And we see a lot of this beginning around 2005, when we see the first Israel Apartheid Week that was launched by students in the Arab Student Collective at the University of Toronto. And this was followed up a year later in 2006. Students at the Arab Cultural Society at Oxford University also launched an Israel Apartheid Week. Around that same time, we see students here in the US at Georgetown, UC Berkeley, and elsewhere also launching Israel Apartheid Week campaigns, all of which were aimed to draw attention to the idea that Israel is practicing forms of apartheid. Meanwhile, as you noted in your intro, Palestinian human rights groups have also been working with international human rights groups to examine Israel's policies and practices. There was a major report in 2009 that found Israel's laws and policies, specifically in the occupied territories, fit the international definition of apartheid. And again, importantly, that Israel is practicing the hallmarks of colonialism, which are also illegal under international law. And then finally, over the last decade, we've seen Palestinians turning to a combination of grassroots mobilization on the ground and social media campaigns, which have been quite potent. So many of us are familiar with the Sheikh Jarrah mobilizations. So that's a combination of local on the ground mobilization to raise awareness about the systematic attempts to dispossess Palestinians of their homes. But it was combined with social media campaigns, hashtag campaigns, and infographics linking that what's happening in Sheikh Jarrah to larger projects of Israeli settler colonialism and apartheid. And so to sum up, for over half a century now, Palestinian intellectuals, activists, and human rights groups have been calling attention to Israel's system of apartheid and its links to Israel's settler colonial project. So I would argue they're actually the ones who have been moving the Overton window, making it more palatable, making it more inescapable, that the idea that Israel is practicing apartheid, a system of apartheid. And so it's gratifying to see other non-Palestinian voices affirming what Palestinians have said, affirming that this isn't a conflict between two equal sides, but rather a system of domination and resistance. So that's all gratifying, but I think there's still a ways to go, and we'll continue talking about it, I think, this hour.
Thank you. That is great foundation for this conversation. Peter, another piece of the foundation, can you talk about the evolution of reactions to the term apartheid from defenders of Israel, including among Jewish progressives? It feels like in parallel to the increasing recognition that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid, Israel and its defenders are evolving and adapting the classic tactic of claiming anti-Semitism to repel challenges to Israeli policies and actions that embody apartheid. Can you talk about what's new in this dynamic, according to which, for instance, challenging Israel's right to commit the crime of apartheid is framed as ipso facto anti-Semitic, or that challenges or that it challenges Israel's right to exist as a quote-unquote Jewish state, or denies the quote-unquote Jewish right to self-determination.
Sorry about that. I think part of what's so important in trying to make this conversation help people to understand realities on the ground, especially in the Jewish community, is to unpack what some of these words mean. Because I think sometimes the way they are heard and experienced may not actually be reflective of the situation on the ground. So I actually want to say a couple of things. First of all, when many Jews hear the words racial or racialized, their response is, well, we're not a race, right? Hitler thought we're a race, we're not a race. So one of the things that's important to understand is that when in the context of international definitions of apartheid, race can also mean what we might call ethno-religious group, right? It's a much broader concept of race than we might sometimes have when we think about in the United States. The second is that I think when many Jews hear the term settler colonialism, what they may hear is a denial of any Jewish historic connection to Israel-Palestine. But that's not, in fact, certainly the way I understand what it means to talk about settler colonialism. Right? I woke up this morning and I prayed for a Jewish return to Jerusalem, as Jews have for thousands of years. Talking about settler colonialism doesn't deny that deep historic Jewish connection, but it is a way of talking about the processes of domination and expulsion that have actually taken place on the ground. And I think similarly, when many people hear the term apartheid, they think, well, that was a South African word. It's an Afrikaner word. And in South Africa, Black South Africans didn't have the right to vote, but there are Palestinian citizens of Israel in the Knesset and even in this government. But so it's important to understand that apartheid has an international legal definition, which means racial domination by one group over another, legalized racial domination. Again, race meaning broadly encompassed enough to encompass things like ethnicity and religion in this case. And I think those things are often lost because, frankly, I think a lot of the people who respond to this are not actually interested in actually understanding the realities on the ground and the international legal frameworks. What they're interested in doing is giving people a way of not having to engage with those very, very painful and difficult realities. If you're someone who was raised in a context in which criticizing Israel was something that you were raised not to do. And so I think what you see in the response is, and I've been struck again and again by this response, is how little of it is actually a genuine detailed rebuttal of the work in these reports. The work in the reports goes into, and Paul, I'm sure we'll go into, goes into great detail about things like Israeli land law, for instance, the Israel land authority, why it is that Palestinians, although inside the green line, Palestinian citizens, right, although they're 20% of the population, live on 2 to 3% of the land. That's not a coincidence. It's because almost all the land is state land and it's controlled by a body that is basically functions for the good of Israel's Jewish citizens, not for its Palestinian citizens, let alone the millions of Palestinian non-citizens under Israeli control in the West Bank and Gaza. But I find that generally there's no response to that. What there is the claim that anti-Semitism is on the rise, which it may well be, and that attacking Israel in these harsh terms will fuel anti-Semitism. And so essentially it turns the entire conversation away from the substantive claims that are made and the lived reality of Palestinians on the ground to the question of Jewish fears about anti-Semitism. Those fears are genuine and extremely important, but surely they're not the right way to deal with them is not to essentially say, because we have fears of anti-Semitism, therefore we're going to try to shut down a conversation about the bigotry that Palestinians face on a daily basis. There's something actually deeply perverse about that move, right? Because the whole point of the reason anti-Semitism is wrong is because it's a form of bigotry. And so if you use then claims of anti-Semitism and the language of anti-Semitism to try to shut down a conversation about the structural bigotry that another group of people are facing, it seems to me there's something fundamentally kind of morally perverse about that. So I think our goal must be to try to, or I see my goal as someone inside the Jewish community in particular, is trying to help people move towards a focus on the realities on the ground that these reports and that Palestinians for decades and decades have trying to be brought to attention. And I actually truly believe that the best way to fight anti-Semitism is through a struggle against all forms of bigotry, which has to include anti-Palestinian bigotry. That these two, this work must work in, we must work in parallel against these two things, and that trying to fight anti-Semitism at the exclusion of facing the bigotry that Palestinians face, of course, is a denial of Palestinians' rights to not suffer legalized discrimination, but I actually think doesn't make us safer either.
Thanks, Peter. And I think it's worth noting also in that reaction part, the idea that for me, the idea that for years, people have in the Jewish progressive community have cited, they've used the word apartheid to talk about a future threat on the horizon. But it seems to be sort of one of those horizons that is always receding, right? You're allowed to talk about apartheid in that hypothetical, but not as something that might actually be here. Paul, I want to turn to you and picking up on where Peter left off, the actual report. So that report runs more than 250 pages. People talk about it as if it's like, you know, two pages of just, you know, criticism. It is a deeply researched, massive tome, which I recommend everyone read. I want to quote it. So describing it, Amnesty says, Amnesty's new investigation shows that Israel imposes a system of oppression and domination against Palestinians across all areas under its control, Israel and the OPT, and against Palestinian refugees in order to benefit Jewish Israelis. All right, that's the short version. So can you address the purpose of the report? What was Amnesty hoping to achieve with this research, and why put Israel front and center? And can you share, for the clarity of our listeners here, the main findings and recommendations? And can you do all of that in 5 minutes?
Yes. Well, Lara, thanks for having me on. Thanks for your leadership in this space and for convening this conversation. It's great to be on with Maha and Peter and to follow them. And I think my comments will follow theirs, but from Amnesty's perspective. So, as an international human rights organization known to you all, we saw our role in this context as really building on the forms, much of the forms of analysis that Maha refers to. We by no means thought of ourselves as early entrants to this human rights conversation. It's been going on in Palestinian communities for as long as Maha raises, and Israeli human rights groups like B'Tselem and then Human Rights Watch last year. So we added our voice, but what was our voice and what was our purpose? As Amnesty, we know two things. We know international law, particularly as it pertains to human rights, and we know how to garner evidence on the ground through a process of interviews, document reviews, and by a pretty forensic analysis of the realities as we understand them through our evidence gathering. So just to complement what you've heard, our take on this was that something profoundly important happened in 1965 from an international human rights perspective, which is that in the International Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which entered into force, it became an official document in 65, but entered into force in 69. Under Article 3, state parties were bound to eliminate apartheid, and apartheid as a word. So it then gained a franchise in international human rights law. The elements of apartheid were later defined in the Apartheid Convention and the Rome Statute, essentially the statute that brought the International Criminal Court into being, laying out the elements of it. And this is important. In 1979, Israel ratified ICERD. And in 1994, and this is important if you're the American section of the Amnesty movement, in a rare moment of international engagement with legal treaty bodies, the United States ratified ICERD. And, you know, the United States is one of two countries that hasn't signed the Convention on the Rights of the Child. It hasn't signed the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. So it's really important that the U.S. signed up and committed itself to a convention that committed it to do what it could to eliminate apartheid. The elements of the crime of apartheid, then we looked at, there are a variety of elements. They've been touched on here. They include the fact that there must be racial discrimination between one citizen population and another. There must be inhumane acts. It must be done with the purpose of maintaining that system of discrimination and so on. What we did in our 280 pages was to identify those elements and to see whether they applied in the context, not just of the occupied Palestinian territories, but in Israel proper. And we found that with respect to every element from a human rights legal perspective, they did. And so that's the report that we published. For us, yes, the reaction since then, we have sought to explain that our finding of apartheid, which we also found the government of Myanmar to be in violation of with respect to the Rohingya people in 2017, is an international legal standard, which we applied then and now we apply to Israel and will apply to other contexts as circumstances arise and capacity on our side arises, and where we think we can build on the efforts of other organizations to foster this understanding, which we were able to do in this context. But it has been surprising to us, as you've said, that instead of us having a conversation about the legal elements of the standard, whether there is ongoing fragmentation of Palestinian communities across Gaza, the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, and so on, whether there is systematic dispossession of land, where you've seen what, if you look at, you know, in the West Bank, if in 67, there was 100% of the land controlled by Palestinians is now around 40% over that period, whether there is divestment in basic social services for Palestinian communities that has been experienced, not just in Gaza and the West Bank, but also in Israel proper. We haven't been having a conversation about those elements of the legal standard and the elements of apartheid. Instead, we've been having conversations about motives and why we would do this in the first place. One of our core concerns here, which was well said by your other speakers, is ultimately, as an international human rights organization, what we are concerned about is the full enjoyment of all human rights for all civilians in the jurisdiction in question. So, yes, of course, we're going to be fundamentally concerned about any law that reserves certain political rights for only part of the population and not for the remainder of the population, which in our view was the case with the 2018 nation state law, which reserves the right of self-determination to only one part of the population in Israel. So that in short is what our report sought to do, which was to document why this is not just in the views of other organizations, a reality of a political and historical and cultural dimension. From our perspective as Amnesty International, it is grounded in international human rights law and it is proven by the evidence. Those were the two contributions we sought to make.
Terrific. Thank you, Paul. So that's a great starting point. That's the great foundation for the rest of our conversation. Peter, I want to come back to you in the second round. So back in 2020, you published a long form essay in the New York Times entitled, "I No Longer Believe in a Jewish State." And in that essay, you argue that, quote, "it's time to imagine a Jewish home that is not a Jewish state." So that essay obviously drew a lot of controversy, and that was before the broader normalization of this apartheid framing. Looking at how the dynamics around defending the Israeli status quo are evolving, can you talk about what you meant with that essay and how your own thoughts are evolving in that matter?
Sure. I supported a Jewish state alongside a Palestinian state my entire adult life, based on a fundamental belief that as a Jew, I have a special obligation to think about the welfare of the Jewish people who are conceived of in Jewish tradition as a kind of an extended family, but also a fundamental moral universal obligation to all people, especially people that my own people, the Jewish people, are dominating and oppressing. And I thought that a partition, which was the dominant discussion in the 1990s, as Maha said, might be a way of addressing that. But the reality is that through subsidizing settlement growth on the ground, Israel has made the possibility of a viable Palestinian state more and more and more remote. So that the two-state solution has really become really a placeholder that people can point to while they accept the status quo. And also beyond that, that the two-state solution, at least as kind of understood generally in kind of mainstream American political discourse, doesn't deal with some of the fundamental realities that I think if one believes in justice and equality, one has to engage with. So for instance, the question is, why is it ethical that that a Jew who was not born in Israel, Palestine, whose parents were not born there, whose grandparents are not born there, can go there like myself and become citizen on day one, and yet a Palestinian who was born in Sfat or in Haifa or in Jaffa or their children or grandchildren cannot? But that seems to me fundamentally at a kind of a, just at a very baseline, obvious level, something fundamentally morally indefensible about that. And the notion that Palestinian citizens should be expected to be second-class citizens in a way that, for instance, American Jews would never be comfortable being second-class citizens in the United States, in a country that explicitly defined itself as having an obligation to Christian Americans that it did not have to us. So out of that, I would say, confusion I had about how to deal with these competing moral impulses. Again, my responsibilities to my people and my responsibilities to grapple with these moral truths that are becoming more and more obvious. Maybe they should have been obvious to me earlier. I began to look at people who had been trying to think about what one equal state might mean. A lot of that writing, much of that writing is Palestinian writing. And I would say one of the things that was very important for me reading that, particularly Edward Said's writing, but other writing, was Palestinians who envisioned a one equal state as a place that would also be a home for Jews, not only for Palestinians. And I also was very influenced by a strain of Zionism. Now, again, I understand that the word Zionism has very, very powerful meanings, which is very different than other people. But there is also a tradition of non-state cultural Zionism, going back to Machad Ha'am through people in like Martin Buber in the group Brit Shalom, that saw the importance of a Jewish presence, a Jewish society, a Jewish home in Palestine, Israel. That was not, where they separated that from the notion of a state that would privilege Jews over Palestinians. I do think it is extremely important for the Jewish people that we have a thriving Jewish society in Palestine, Israel, where people can speak Hebrew, they can do a certain kind of cultural production. But there is a tradition that makes a clear distinction between that and the notion of legal supremacy of Jews over Palestinians. And it was, I think, those two influences, the notion that there was a different notion of Jewish home, which was separate from Jewish statehood in our tradition. Achad Ha'am knew a heck of a lot more about Judaism than Theodore Herzl ever did. And that there were Palestinians who had been for a long period of time laying out an inclusive vision of an equal state that said, you are welcome in this equal state. For me, that created an opening. Again, there's very little in my writing that is really, again, that's saying anything new. But I think by putting these things together, I was able to find my way to a different place. And I think that it's a very, very, very difficult and painful process for a lot of people. But the more obvious it is that the two-state solution is no longer an option, the more I think people are going to have to grapple, whether they want to admit it publicly or not, about whether they're willing to take that move or whether they're going to be defenders of a status quo that is just by any reasonable stretch, not morally defensible.
Thanks, Peter. Paul, I want to come back to you. And recently you spoke about the Amnesty Report at an event that was convened by the Women's National Democratic Club. And we'll put the link in the chat. I highly recommend people actually read the transcript or listen to the whole thing or watch it in full rather than just reading maybe sensationalized reports about what was or wasn't said. But some of your words were seized on by defenders of Israel to both attack you personally and to attack Amnesty and the report. I'm going to read here the main quote that got you in trouble because I think it's worth reading. Quote, "My gut tells me that what Jewish people in this country want is to know that there is a sanctuary that is a safe and sustainable place that the Jewish people can call home. But I think they can be convinced over time that the key to sustainability is to adhere to what I see as core Jewish values, which are to be principled and fair and just in creating that space. I think most Jewish people in this country would like to see the both and of a safe Jewish space, right? So both safe and sustainable, a safe Jewish space and that state not to be built on a legal system of disenfranchising people in that country. I don't think that's a comfort zone for the Jewish community. Okay, so as I read it, and I'm sorry I stumbled on it, but people can read it for themselves. Fundamentally, what you are talking about is the tension that exists between international law on the one hand, that is the inalienable right of all people no matter where they live, and on the other hand, the inalienable rights, and on the other hand, the assertion by Israel that it has an unchallengeable right to maintain and undertake whatever policies or actions it sees fit in the service of the security of its Jewish citizens, the implementation of a Jewish right to self-determination, or to preserve Israel's existence as a Jewish state, as opposed to, and here I will quote the Interior Minister Ayelet Shaked, when she tweeted about a new the re-upping of an Israeli law that denies the right to family reunification for Palestinian citizens of Israel, she defiantly stated that this is a win for those who don't support a state of all its citizens. A state of all its citizens is her words. So can you talk about this tension, variations of which exist with respect to other governments around the world and their rejection when it suits them of international law? And can you talk about why Amnesty and other human rights defenders believe that for the sake of all parties, international law must prevail?
Thanks, Lara. Well, it's particularly good to be on this call with all of you and to follow what Peter just said, because the first thing I need to say is I do regret articulating in any way or claiming to represent what the views of Jewish people. That that was a moment I regret. And as is very evident from this conversation, the views of the Jewish people are best represented by Jewish people themselves. Your question spoke, though, more broadly. What was the underlying human rights analysis that I was trying to bring to that question that I received? Well, first, I mean, it's unfortunate that I have to clarify it, but I should, that Amnesty, of course, it believes in the right of the Jewish people to self-determination. That's never been in doubt. It also believes in the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. And to the extent that we have anything to say about how future scenarios can best enable everybody in the context to enjoy human rights, it is essentially, you have to start from that premise. You have to start from the premise that your goal is the full enjoyment of all human rights for everybody in the context. And if you ask me, you know, do I think that that's possible or sustainable? As a human rights activist, I'm always going to tell you that that's always going to be the most sustainable long-term outcome for communities and societies to live in health. So that's essentially where we are.
Thank you. So Maha, back to you. The debate around Amnesty's report, it has shined a bright light. We're looking at this today on a contradiction Palestinians have talked about for decades. And this is the contradiction between Israel defining itself as a Jewish state and implementing policies openly in line with that definition on both sides of the green line. That's not a matter of debate. That's a matter of pride for Ayelet Shaked and others, while at the same time demanding that it be recognized as a liberal democracy that governs by rule of law. Can you talk about how the shift that we are seeing at present in Palestinian activism, particularly from younger activists, away from a peace process conflict resolution framework to focus instead on demanding rights as defined under international law, how it reflects that very tension?
Sure. Thanks for that. So yes, you're absolutely right. I think particularly in the 1990s, we saw a lot of this discourse around peace framework, conflict resolution. This was a time when we saw a lot of Israeli-Palestinian dialogue groups emerging on both sides of the green line. It was the heyday of Seeds of Peace, which brought Israeli, Palestinian, and Arab youth to the woods of Maine. The assumption behind all of these initiatives is that if you brought Palestinians and Israelis together, and they learned about each other's experiences, and they discovered their shared love of hummus, you could somehow end the conflict and have peace. Now, the catch with that framework, and this is something that young Palestinians realized early on, is that this approach completely ignores the structures of power and domination inherent in any Israeli-Palestinian encounter. So it's great for a 15-year-old Israeli boy and a 15-year-old Palestinian boy to be bunkmates in Maine. They discover their love of skateboarding. They have family traumas. Okay. But then what happens 3 years later when that Israeli joins the military and then proceeds to arrest his former bunkmate on so-called security charges? What good did that summer in Maine do for either of them? And so that peace framework wasn't giving Palestinian youth or, frankly, Israeli youth the political or the analytical tools that they needed to even begin to tackle the structural violence that Palestinians faced on a daily basis under occupation, under Israeli domination inside the Green Line, the exclusion that they face as refugees, not to mention all of the entrenched systems of apartheid and colonialism. So the conflict resolution framework posits the idea or the assumption that there are two equal sides. They both need to get to know one another, compromise a bit more, and if they just push a little harder, we can have peace. So that doesn't work, which is why over the last 20 years or so, we've seen this shift among Palestinian youth activists, again, on both sides of the Green Line and around the world. And this younger generation has been much more focused on naming Israeli structures of oppression, even when it makes people feel uncomfortable, even when they face that knee-jerk reaction that both Peter and Paul have been talking about. I think it's also important to mention the harassments and attacks that Palestinian youth activists have been facing for the last decades, from government authorities, from pro-Israel advocacy groups, from university administrations. And they've had to withstand those personal attacks, often at great cost to themselves. So you mentioned this tension between Israel as a Jewish state and Israel as a professed liberal democracy. And defenders of Israel often point to Palestinian citizens of Israel specifically as evidence of Israel's supposed liberal democratic values, which is why I think it's especially telling that among the Palestinian youth activists that we've seen emerging, so many of them have been Palestinian youth activists based inside the Green Line. So 48 Palestinians, Palestinian citizens of Israel, including a large number of women, I want to also have it be known, that have been at the forefront of the mobilizations of the last year, and particularly of the Unity Intifada of last year. So part of what made last May's Unity Intifada so significant was that it marked the first time that you had grassroots Palestinian mobilization and coordination across the Green Line, from the one-day general strike to the other forms of mass mobilization. And it was those very Palestinians inside the Green Line, those who've been told their whole lives, you are part of a liberal democracy. You are not like those other Palestinians over there under occupation because you have rights here in this country. Those youth who've been living their lives have come to the realization, no, we don't. We also suffer under Israeli settler colonial and apartheid rule, just in different manifestations of it. And the crackdown on protesters inside the Green Line, Palestinian citizens, the waves of arrests, the waves of beatings and other forms of torture and violations of human rights that they faced reinforced for many of them that they actually do live under an occupying army, that you can't separate out Israel's tactics that they use with occupied Palestinians. You can't separate that out from the tactics they use for Palestinians inside the Green Line. I think that first came into kind of realization in October of 2000, when Israel killed 13 unarmed Palestinian protesters inside the Green Line. And so these kinds of realizations have led to a much more systematic understanding and definition of Palestinians' struggle as being shared across the Green Line and as being shared in the face of Israeli apartheid and settler colonialism, even if the manifestations of those systems look a bit different depending on where Palestinians are living.
Thank you, Maha. So Paul, I want to come back to you. So maybe shift something a little more positive, right? So there's obviously a lot of chatter online, in Congress, in the media, about criticism of the report and a criticism of Amnesty, which doesn't surprise anyone probably who's watching or listening to this conversation. But can you tell us about some of the positive responses you've received in the US and around the world and the impact, the positive impact you see the report already having? This seems like an important part of the story that maybe isn't getting nearly the attention it should.
Thanks, Lara. Well, I mean, honestly, to build off what you opened this conversation with, we feel like we are just one more piece in a puzzle that has been becoming more and more clear to more and more people over time, thinking of everything that Maha talked about and the work of leaders on the ground in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Obviously, it really matters that the United Nations Special Rapporteur last week came out with the same finding. Our sense is that this is a conversation from a human rights perspective whose time is long overdue. And our hope is that by putting the 280 pages of evidence and legal analysis into the mix, we are going to see the corner turn from what is a fairly stale set of questions around why are we having this question, this conversation, to a conversation around, okay, so what are the elements of this international human rights crime, which we should be talking about dismantling. And our hope is that we can get from the generalized finding to issues of what we're seeing in terms of the dispossession of Palestinian homes, the divestment in economic and social rights across the territories, the fact that it is, and this I think has been something of, we have been adding our voice to B'Tselem and others, but I think it has sort of raised the level of conversation about how the reality of the system of apartheid, not just the crime of apartheid, is experienced by Palestinians, whether they live in East Jerusalem in Sheikh Jarrah, whether they live down in the Negev, or they're in the West Bank or in Gaza, and how the system of oppression and domination actually relates across these territories in ways that are experienced by Palestinians in an integrated way wherever they live in those geographies. So yes, we are hopeful that this contribution to what has been a building discussion is going to deepen the conversation about human rights law and the actual evidence, and then the very specific policies that both the government of Israel, which is duty bound under international human rights law, but also key influencers like the US government will take much more seriously as they seek to advance policy in the region.
Thank you. And look, we're having events like this, so obviously the debate is already shifting. So that is a positive response in its own way. Maha, I want to come back to you again. We're talking about the report itself. There's been a lot of criticism of the Amnesty report and the Human Rights Watch report from forces that are defending Israel from criticism. Far less attention has been given to Palestinian criticism of the reports. Can you just briefly here explain the core objections that have been articulated by some Palestinian intellectuals and activists and why they really are important to hear and understand?
Sure. So there are a couple of articles that I would draw listeners' attention to that I think articulate well some of the core Palestinian objectives, even as we welcome the report itself as affirming a lot of what Palestinians have been saying for decades. So the first article is a critique laid out probably a week after the report came out by Dr. Lana Tatour. She's a Palestinian political scientist. She's currently based in Australia. And her research focuses on how Israel's policies towards Palestinian citizens of Israel particularly also are tools of settler colonial domination. So we often assume that colonialism and political participation are elements of Israel's liberal democracy. She argues that they're actually ways of exerting domination and control over those Palestinian citizens. So she wrote an article in Middle East Eye, and I'll quote just a brief passage from it. She wrote, quote, "While the recent acknowledgement by the international human rights community of Israeli apartheid is important, the apartheid frame must include a settler colonial analysis and a recognition of Zionism as the racial ideology that drives settler colonialism and apartheid in Palestine. Refusing to acknowledge the racial foundations of Zionism when discussing Israeli apartheid is like refusing to address white supremacy when discussing the Black Lives Matter movement, unquote. So she's arguing, and others have argued, that apartheid is the symptom, but if we're going to dismantle it, we need to understand the cause, and we need to name that cause. And the cause in this case is settler colonialism and racial domination. She explains further in a podcast interview that she gave in Mondowais that ignoring settler colonialism also there by extension ignores decolonization. And so if we don't understand or recognize decolonization, again, we don't have the tools to dismantle either apartheid or colonialism, because extending equal rights to Palestinians within an Israeli state isn't going to really solve the problem if the fundamental underpinnings of Israel as a Jewish state are inherently unequal. So that's one critique laid out by Lana Faltour. The second, and I would encourage listeners to read it as well, is by Suhair Asad and Rania Muharrab, both Palestinian human rights experts. And they had an article published in the Institute for Palestine Studies called Dismantle What? They argue, like Lana Faltour, they argue, and I'll quote from them briefly, that the Amnesty Report, quote, fails to recognize apartheid as a tool of Zionist settler colonialism and fails to consider the role of Zionist ideology and institutions in establishing and maintaining the system, unquote. So again, an analysis of the symptoms, but not of the causes and the ideologies that underpin them. Asad and Muharrab were also critical of some of the public statements and tweets that Amnesty International put out when the report came out, particularly its stance that Amnesty takes no position against Israel's occupation. And so they argue that those public statements, in fact, undermine a lot of what's valuable in Amnesty International's report, and particularly undermine some of the work that Palestinian researchers who are part of the team, some of what they did in terms of drafting and finding information, field and desk research, their efforts to reframe the discourse, right? So again, focusing on the symptoms rather than the cause. And I recognize that that might not be the purview of Amnesty International, but I think that the policing of the discourse along the lines of what we've been talking about limits our ability to see the limitations of the report and the ability to then move beyond it as well, or to use the report as a launching ground for a larger discussion.
Thank you, Maha. I think that's so important and really helpful. And I also encourage people to take a look at both of those articles. They're really important.
We have to end it there. You have been listening to a conversation with Laura Friedman, president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, Paul O'Brien of Amnesty International, and Dr. Maha Nasser from the University of Arizona. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time and on KKRN.org every Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday morning for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.